time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
Okay, I know that Richard Fitzwilliams will take on board the fact that he probably wouldn't actually have much to say about electronic vehicle charger because he's not a car owner. But when it comes to etiquette, there's only one person we can actually go to actually find out the real details with respect to that. And that, of course, is a former Royal Butler, the Royal Butler, let's face it, Grant Harold. How are you, Grant?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. It was great to connect with you yourself again. But I must admit, this is something which had passed me by. But thinking about it, if we're looking at etiquette as being rules, good manners, ways to actually operate, etc., if you actually have an electronic vehicle, if you have an EV car that's actually there, you might think, great for the environment. But if you suddenly turn up with the family and then expect to charge it as well, that's quite a little hike. I mean, especially when you acknowledge that charging a car can be between £17 and £28 per vehicle. I was also thinking, Grant, what if you've got extended families and different families coming in there, etc.? Suddenly, your entire Christmas budget might just go on charging the rest of the family's cars.
And accordance, I should quickly mention that Direct Line Car Insurance did the research into this, which is amazing. And I hadn't thought about this either, Alice. I didn't think about electric vehicle etiquette over Christmas. In fact, we've even, which we maybe can go back to, but we've created top six etiquette tips on this because it's just not come up before. Because we all think with Christmas etiquette about all the traditional things about timings and food and drink and presents, but we don't think about
or at least
getting
providing
there.
Stables for the horses to actually rest up on.
Well, exactly, or the reindeer, we should say. The research is really interesting. Just a couple of quick things from the research. A quarter of those that took part, 2,000 people, I believe, took part. A quarter, 23% of owners have said they've been refused to be allowed to top up, to recharge when visiting family, friends or family members. And the other one that was quite staggering was 1 in 10, 8% admit they'll never let their friends or family charge their vehicles. So it's obviously a real problem. You did mention about the money. Apparently across the UK, it's 9 million it costs with all these charges. So it's cost of living crisis. Of course, it's a discussion, it's a debate. My argument, I'm trying to obviously promote goodwill, Christmas. Of course, you're going to offer, if someone comes to you with a mobile phone, he's charging, you're going to charge the phone. A car, I'm saying you should. Cost of living, I appreciate that. So what I'm also saying is if you go and visit someone's home, offer to pay to do this. Don't just assume you can charge. Just ask if there's somewhere they can charge the car, and hopefully they'll say you can charge it here. And then you say, well, in that case, I will pay you for that. And they'll probably say no, but you can be insistent. You can even put the money in an envelope and leave it somewhere for them, as long as it's not going to offend them. And if you really think it's going to offend them, then get them a gift. So that's the whole, this etiquette around the vehicles are the kind of things that we should be thinking about.
I mean, it's astounding to find that a fifth of us wouldn't charge for charging their electric vehicle, but they do admit they'd be annoyed if their loved ones didn't at least offer a contribution towards the cost. I mean, all of these things, I suppose, boil to potentially. I mean, we know that Christmas can be fraught with tension at the best of times, and we know that sometimes families have tensions as well. This could literally be the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back, couldn't it, Grant?
It could, because, and it is this awkward thing, isn't it, I'm just also reading here about there's an age split, which is really interesting. 17% of 18 to 34-year-olds are comfortable asking for the contribution, where 55+, 5% are not, obviously, are not keen. So it just shows you how, younger people are more likely to kind of say yes, with the older are probably less likely to say yes. But that's just, that's just an age thing, isn't it? I think when you're younger, you're probably a bit more, you probably say it more as it is, but as you get older and wiser, it's what you just said a minute ago. If you get asked and you say no, that's fine. It's the principle. It's all about principle, isn't it? It's the principle of suggesting and then giving the person the chance to say no. And most people would probably just say no, but maybe that's what this is all about, is people just turning up at someone's home and just saying, can I use it? I need to use your car charger. Just assuming and then using it, and then you get your bill in and notice there's an extra £20 or something. It's just really bad manners. So that's why with Direct Line, we've come up with these tips, which you can find on the directline.com website, which has got the tips, which I'm obviously promoting because I think this is as well as all the traditional, I'm all for all the other etiquette tips because they're really important. But this is just one of them that also that helps.
I suppose there is an argument which says that if you're visiting a relative who doesn't have an electric car charger, then at least just ask for where the nearest public one is, and that might solve the issue from that perspective.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm kind of saying. When you go to someone's home, you could always just say, is there one? Because the chances are there's one nearby and you can just go there on the way, and then that keeps it even easier. But I know the convenience of turning up someone's home. If they've got a garage right there, you can plug the car in, go in. It's easier, it's quicker. Also, if you're charging the car on the way, you've got to sit and wait for so long. Where at the house, you can just put a timer on your phone and then go in and start having a few, non-alcoholic drinks, obviously, if you're driving, having a few drinks and then going out and then jumping in the car and then going home. Of course, what you don't want to happen is someone come into the house, not telling you they haven't got much electricity. Suddenly they go to leave, they haven't got enough fuel to go, energy to go, and then you've got to provide accommodation for them, which is not probably ideal.
Well, although I suppose there could be a stable that could be in the backstop that could actually be there, which would
They
be very
could
much in
be a
keeping with the.
they could be a stay. Maybe that's what happened many two centuries ago or 2 millennia ago. Maybe that's what happened.
It was all down to the electric vehicle charging point. It would come full
Yeah,
circle.
exactly. Can you imagine?
Stoney, where can people find out more details about this direct line? Fascinating insight in terms of reasons that you would let a friend or relative charge their electronic vehicle or electric vehicle at your own home, if of course you've got a charging point.
Thank you, Alex. Well, directline.com is obviously you go for all your kind of obviously normal insurance inquiries. However, because of this research, all the research, the tips, everything can all be found there. So it's worth having a little look, having a little read into it if you get a chance.
And I suppose with Santa's sleigh, of course, with respect to that, I mean, it's added a whole new aspect to that. I mean, do you actually leave out the milk, the cookies, and electric charging point for the reindeer as well? I mean, that could be another issue.
Well, here's the thing. I'm more thinking along the lines of if Santa turns up and say the reindeer are on holiday this year and he's got his electric sleigh, are you going to refuse him to top
Well,
up? There's the question. Or are you going to ask him to pay for that? So that's a whole other debate to be had later, I think.
it's one of the reasons, Grant, why you will never be out of work when it comes to etiquette. And I'm sure King Charles would actually agree with respect to that. Grant, it's been amazing connecting with your good self as ever. Have a fantastic holiday season, and hopefully we'll speak again in 2024.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone else. I appreciate it. Have a good Christmas.
Well, I wonder if actually Richard has even thought about e-vehicles. Clearly, from the discussion we had with the former Royal Butler to King Charles, the answer is highly unlikely, but we'll find out. Anyway, Natasha Wanter's back with us. How are you, Natasha?
Hello, I'm very glad to be back. I'm doing very well and now have got over the mild jet lag, so that's always good.
So, where did this delayed due to COVID and other things honeymoon take you from Australia to which part of the globe?
So we finally got to go back to Japan, but this was kind of sort of a medley of new and old for me because I've done several places we went. We Osaka, Kyoto, and obviously living in Kanagawa, I was in Tokyo quite a lot. But this was the first time I saw myself in Nagasaki, so it was very nice to sort of be there and sort of experience a city that isn't actually well known of, apart from obviously its very tragic events that happened in 1945. But actually, if you look beyond sort of that sort of very tragic event, there's a really interesting and complex history there, and that sort of opened Japan up to its industrial era that I wasn't really aware of. So it was very enlightening, and I
Yeah.
do love my history, as you know, Alex. So it was
And
a very
that's
good
why
trip.
you should read Mr. Two Bomb by William Coles, if you haven't already, who actually goes into the Nagasaki and Hiroshima challenges that, of course, set the pace for arguably our modern world. Fia van den Bogaert in The Joys of the Netherlands. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Marvellous. Do you care about the Golden Globes?
Oh yeah, no, I always like to watch the list and
Okay.
who I'm very bad at predicting who will win, but I
Yeah.
always try to predict like, oh, maybe that one will win this year.
Well, predictions, sort of things that can engage with in all sorts of other areas, etc. But I can also turn around and say, Richard Fitzwilliams, I think we were probably right when I was chatting with Grant, former butler to King Charles. You have no interest whatsoever in electric vehicles, do you? Or recharging them?
I'm sorry, Alex, there was a glitch, a sound glitch. I didn't hear the comment.
Electric vehicles, Richard. You have no interest in them whatsoever.
My electric, I'm afraid I don't drive, Alex, as a result. From the point of view of the climate change area, naturally, that is where things are going. But I can only say that I'm only too delighted when I see cars pass me. Public transport is fine. What is the connection, however, between electric vehicles and the Golden Globes? I can only say that the Golden Globes, I hope that their best future is not behind them, because the challenge, and when you have a category for popular film, you've also got Barbie and Oppenheimer, 9 and 8 nominations respectively. All of this, of course, is hoping to draw an audience. Now, last year's audience, I think, was 6.3 million, and also that's terribly low. And also previously they had a serious problem with lack of diversity. To what extent, this begs a question, or awards ceremonies can get back on track. I'm not suggesting that the Oscars can, say, replicate what happened with Titanic in 1997, which is the record audience, but nonetheless, they are struggling. And as far as the Globes are concerned, they always had a glamorous beginning to this, the season, dating back to the 1940s. I hope they can, in some way, get quite an audience back. And I think this year, when you have got movies like Barbie and Oppenheimer, and of course Poor Things, which we're about to discuss, and a variety of other films, they've been a very, very high standard, very high standard. Past Lives, another one. It's not Anatomy of a Fall, another. It's not that there aren't the good films. It's that people have gone back to live performances and live audiences and so on the stage. And I mean, less so, there's no doubt, still on film. I can see this where I go every week.
Well, for what it's worth, I will say that the Golden Globe winner for Best Film will be Killers of the Flower Moon. Best Film Musical Comedy will be Barbie, and the rest of it pretty much up for grabs. Anna, Golden Globes in Romania,
Yes.
is that something which appeals to your good self?
Yes, it actually is. We watch them, at least the people I know watch them. And I was actually it was a pleasant surprise to see quite a lot of movies that I did not expect there. I know Barbie had such a huge success, but I would have never expected it to be there, to be honest. Especially in the song category, where it was nominated 3 times, that I know it was, again, a huge success, but 3 nominations in just one category, I don't know, to me it sounds crazy.
Excessive,
But
excessive.
I liked the movie, I really did, but it was a bit too, I don't know, wasn't that huge of a deal to me, to be quite honest. It was nice dressing, pink and going with friends, getting people pink popcorn, singing the songs, but that's kind of it. I think it was what people made of it to be
Well,
quite honest,
Richard
rather
only
than the
went to
movie
Barbie, I
itself.
believe, so he could dress up as Ken, but it's a long-held routine. Anyway, before Natasha actually
That's
throws some
true,
questions
Alex.
at you,
That's true.
would you like us to talk us through these nominations and where you think the winners and riders are going to be?
Well, I mean, I'm actually what I suspect very, very strongly. I think you're right about Killers of the Flower Moon. I think also that Leonardo DiCaprio is an excellent chance as best actor, may well win. Definitely Robert De Niro as well may well win. And Lily Gladstone, best actress. Now, this, of course, there's several top class performers there, but again, I wouldn't be at all surprised, especially with a nod to what would be the first Native American actress to win. And this is, of course, all in the drama category. And I think that so far as the musical comedy are concerned, I think we definitely will have as much of a clean sweep for Barbie as we possibly can, because obviously it's made a fortune. And I think that the awards will want to reflect this, really. I mean, it was Greta Gerwig. I don't, I think that also when it comes to Best Director, I mean, that would be very interesting, because again, there's some absolutely top class films. But as I say, the problem is getting people to the cinema still. And also, of course, the problem is going to get is getting them to actually watch the, you know, the awards.
Well, who knows what the future will actually hold. But anyway, Natasha, over to yourself. I'm just embracing my inner hound dog here. So would you like to just throw your questions to Richard, please?
I don't know if there's so much as questions as so much buckle up, Richard, and hold on to your eyebrows, because I have opinions and I'm not sure you're going to want to hear them. I am so invested in this Golden Globes compared to other years. It's done a really good job in drawing me in, actually, compared to before. I would really, I'm going to try and keep this brief, but because I can talk for the next 10 minutes if you let me. I'm really interested to see how Oppenheimer's going to do. I love Oppenheimer. I would love Cillian Murphy to get Best Actor. I would love Ludwig Göransson to get Best Score. I really hope he does. I think that the atmosphere that he created with his music was excellent. And I would love Christopher Nolan to get some awards, because I think that the way that he shot and put that whole thing together with his vision was excellent. In terms of, we've got the guaranteed wins, haven't you really? Margot Robbie's going to win. Bella Ramsey's going to win for The Last of Us, and The Last of Us is probably going to clean up quite a bit in that department as well. Billie Eilish, I can see taking away from What Are We Made For. I can see that kind of coming up well. Do we really need 3 Barbie songs in the songs category? No. I'm not overly enthused on Barbie. I can see it cleaning up. Yes, it was okay. I thought it was a bit contrite and cliche in places, and but that's just my personal opinion. But I can see it, you know, with the popular appeal cleaning up and people wanting to sustain the vibe to keep it going. In terms of animated, which is kind of a category I do like to watch a lot of, some very interesting choices. I did really much enjoy the Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. I thought that was a great film. Surprising one for me, I guess. Is Elemental. I didn't really talk about it on this podcast, but I really reacted quite emotionally to that film. Just coming from it from a personal perspective, my father also isn't in the best of health, and and, you know, obviously from moving overseas and stuff, sort of that kind of hit me at quite a personal level and broke me down a little bit. So it'll be, I don't think that will win. I don't think it's been particularly popular, but it would be interesting to see what they go with. It's nice to see a lot of sort of Japanese more anime style movies in that animated section as well this time around, some more international nominees. Super Mario might take it. You don't know which way it's going to go. I'm excited to see where it's going to go. All the Light We Cannot See, I can also see that doing well. I'm a bit more dubious about that one. If it introduces, Anthony Doerr's work to the wider masses, that would be great. The book, amazing. The TV show, but if you haven't read the book, I've heard that a lot of people like it. My mother is in raptures over it, and she's not read the book. So I could see that possibly doing quite well as well. I think it's going to be much more exciting than in other years, because of the fact that it can go kind of anywhere. I mean, as I say, there's some guaranteed wins, but it will be interesting.
Absolutely guaranteed. There's no doubt about it. But incidentally, don't you think that since you've enthused in detail on it, that if only that was reflected more widely, I mean, regarding Killers of the Flower Moon versus Oppenheimer, I'm just inclined to Killers as a bet, but Oppenheimer...
They don't like Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan won't win because of his association with Batman and various other factors. He's like Steven Spielberg.
Alex, we're not sure at all. And I mean, this is what would be very exciting. We've got Killers of the Flower Moon and Martin Scorsese against Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer. And I mean, Killers hasn't done terribly well at the box office, but it's got enough. So that isn't going to penalize it, because obviously when it's a financial failure, it doesn't help. But it does make it exciting. We know Margot Robbie and, Barbie, obviously that's a done deal. But a lot of interesting roles in the supporting categories, and also the way Oppenheimer did and has made a lot of money. I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, the time challenged movies where what you're watching on screen isn't necessarily in real time, but it's in a form of, well, Christopher Nolan's time in Inception and also in Tenet, where things were happening that were happening in a sort of reverse time. This sort of movie doesn't appeal to me, but it had enormous, you know, it had a lot of appeal. Tenet didn't do terribly well because, of course, of COVID. But Nolan is a highly respected with Interstellar, with Dunkirk. So, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised, Alex. It makes it exciting, and that's what we want, surely.
Beer, in the Netherlands, in bulk, to be precise. You've been listening, obviously, to the tour de force of Natalie there, who managed to squeeze in more words than I thought possible into a 8-minute period. Any thoughts from yourself?
Well, actually, so the movie that I predicted to win best in the best movie category, I think, should be Oppenheimer, because I think it's a lot better than Killers of the Flower Moon. It appealed to me a lot more. I think how the movie was put together was a lot better than Killers of the Flower Moon. And I agree, yeah, Barbie will probably win in a lot of categories. But I really want Emily Blunt to win in supporting actress, because how she played in Oppenheimer was flawless. And I think I can discuss it now. But the scene where she was interrogated, and oh, she was so strong. I was amazed by her. So I really want her to win.
And no mention of Maestro or Anatomy of a Fall, or indeed the Zone of Interest, which is still, never mind. Richard.
I haven't seen Zone of Interest. I have to say, I'm hoping to see it very soon. So far, and it's a real chiller, that one, no question about it. And I don't think it'll win anything, but it's nice that it is nominated. I mean, I think Maestro, you know, there are two. You've got Bradley Cooper and Carey Mulligan giving absolutely first-class performances. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. It hasn't had the critical raves.
Sadly, no sign of Wonka or indeed Aquaman 2 appearing there, but never mind, maybe next year. Poor Things. Richard, would you like to share with us your thoughts on this not so much festive movie, but perhaps a relation to comedy drama in which a young woman runs off with a lawyer after an unorthodox scientist brings her back to life?
You could say that, Alex. I mean, I have to say, you remember the push me, pull you in Dr. Dolittle?
A classic. If you can go down to the line of Rex Harrison in the quintessential movie that almost bankrupted 20th Century Fox from the 1960s, which we will be covering in a future Resonance Rewind.
Well, I have to say that the song with it was, I've never seen anything like it in my life. And I've never seen anything like Poor Things. It's based on Alistair Gray's novel. It is Yorgos Lanthimos directing, a very unorthodox director, scoring for me with The Favourite, less so with The Lobster, Killing of a Sacred Deer, I found interesting. But I've never seen anything like the 2 hours, 20 minutes of this. I mean, it is outrageous. It is bizarre. It is gloriously colourful. It is indeed a black, very black comedy. And indeed, if you don't think there have been enough sex scenes in films recently, this one makes up for it in spades.
You know, Richard, that hasn't even crossed my mind in terms of the whole thing. You know, frankly, it's a case of why would we bother? You know, I mean, you've got people dying in Ukraine, people dying in Gaza Strip. Why would I worry about, you know, sexuality in cinema? Not at all. Just saying.
Well, may I ask you, Alex, to transport yourself back to Victorian London. And we meet a medical student, Max McCandless, played by Remy Yusuf, who becomes an assistant to a monster, a surgeon who quite literally is a monster, a Frankenstein-like figure. If you look at the face, you'll see what I mean. It's quite hard to give a picture other than the fact, if you think in your Frankenstein movies and you humanize the face a little bit, you've got Dr. Goodwin Baxter, played by Willem Dafoe, very well, I have to say. Now, Max meets and falls in love with Godwin's ward, Bella. Bella Baxter, played by Emma Stone, very interesting. You see the performances in this also nominated for the Golden Globes, and you can see why. She is a child, except that Godwin reveals that she was pregnant, committed suicide by leaping off a bridge. He recovers her corpse, resurrects her by swapping her brain for that of her still-living baby, so she has an infant's mind. This is putting it
sounds like a day in the life of a citizen of Bucharest.
Well, Alex, I would admit it is extraordinary. Max falls in love with her, wants to marry her, she accepts, but as she's starting to mature, you see, this is the whole film is the journey whereby she, in a patriarchal society, she becomes a liberated feminist in various ways. But how? My goodness gracious me. I mean, the sets in this movie, the colour used in this movie, coloured for the first shot where we see a suicide and then subsequently a sort of a grainy colour and then subsequently a colour that links to The Wizard of Oz and Hollywood film sets. There are all sorts of homages here. She runs away from Max and indeed takes off with a rake, a dissolute rake, Duncan Wedderburn, another nominee for the Golden Globes, played by Mark Ruffalo. I don't think, incidentally, it would necessarily win, maybe a technical category or two, but these are all extraordinary performances. And Goodwin begins a new experiment with a girl called Felicity. Now, the film is divided into sections. These are sections. Each section is a city, and each city is an opportunity for the most extraordinary sets. Don't expect anything that is in any way conventional. You've got Max firstly controlling her when she starts getting ideas of her own because she's on this journey and as her brain is developing, as well it might, given what she gets up to, he takes her on a cruise ship. She befriends other passengers and it's perfectly obvious when, in despair, Duncan turns to gambling, she gives all his winnings away and she's affected by the poverty she sees in Alexandra. So they're kicked off the ship because they've got no money and she works in a brothel in Paris. This is where you get lots of scenes which, putting it mildly, are lively. Toinette is another of the prostitutes and also she's underneath, under the strict supervision of Madame Swiney, played by Catherine Hunter. Whilst Godwin becomes terminally ill and asks Max to locate her. Now, what happens? What happens to her and Duncan? What happens, indeed, when a bizarre figure suddenly enters her life and claims that they previously were married? And what is the backstory to that? I mean, this is a sex comedy, a black comedy, with an eye for hilarious one-liners. Emma Stone is amazing. I mean, it has extraordinary scenes, and some people wouldn't prefer to go through the torments of hell and see this rather garish, weird fantasy, which grew on me because I'm not someone who greatly enjoys these sort of films normally. But this is the sets, the costumes, the music, the photography, the whole concept of the thing, the zany weirdness of it. Not everyone will appreciate how explicit it is, but there you have it. Poor Things is 2 hours, 20 minutes, and if you don't like it, I wouldn't, or like the sort of thing, I wouldn't go and see it, except that it did win me over. The whole bizarre weirdness, the wackiness of the whole thing. You know, cinema is about experiment, and we've got a monster Frankenstein, like monster here, and he certainly experiments.
8 out of 10, I suspect, is what you're giving it.
Quite right, Alex. Yeah, you're quite right. Yeah.
Natasha.
Well, I do like weird things, it has been said. So this one might be down my avenue. I could see Emma Stone being really good in this role. I could see her giving that really unhinged sort of personnel and pizzazz to the character. I think Richard, you've won me over. I think I might go and see this one, just to sort of have said that I've lived through the experience, but I would probably have to pick my timings. I'm not sure I'd probably subject my in-laws to this one, but
it is no. One for the in-laws, absolutely, Natasha, but just take it from me and blame me.
Just maybe, I don't know, but if there's a lot of interesting scenes, sort of adult scenes, I'm not sure if it'd be very comfortable.
These are the most graphic sex scenes that I've seen since Passage, and that was rather extraordinary, but certainly with a Hollywood movie, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's just possible the in-laws could raise an eyebrow.
Maybe we'll see. I'll let you know how that one goes.
Try them.
Anna, is this one which you feel okay if I'm not going to spend Christmas in Coventry? Or maybe I am. Maybe Christmas in Coventry plus this is designed to actually make me forget all about Bucharest.
Well, I am already in Coventry, so half of it is done. Well, I don't know if this film is not suited for me, but quite my type, to be quite honest. But the way Richard described it to be made me want to go and watch it, to be quite honest, because he described it, I don't know, like being something that even for him it wasn't something that would have appealed to him at first, but won him over. So when you hear this, said quite a few times, it makes you want to watch it. I don't know. I will definitely let you know if I'm gonna go and watch it and come back with some opinions about it. But for now, I don't know what to say.
Speechless.
I'm
Speechless at Richard's veering to the world of bourgeoisie and corruption and decadence. Well,
To
as I
be
said.
honest, I was speechless since he said about the brain swap with the infant mind. Because at first, when I read about this movie, I think I don't know, passed that by. I have no idea, but when he said that, I was quite speechless. Yeah, you're right.
Well,
Thea
so
van
you
der
see, so in fact is Bella, but she, as she develops, you see, she gets her voice, and as she gets her voice, it's fascinating, born by Emma Stone, you see she gets up to all sorts of things.
Yeah,
Thea
I
van der.
really like Mark Ruffalo and Emma Stone as well. So I think by this it means it's a really good movie. So it's another point on why to watch it. So
Well, if you've got the Incredible Hulk in there, I suppose it adds a whole new range to the Frankenstein mythology. Thea van den Bogart, finally, any thoughts from yourself in
well,
that
exactly.
very forward-thinking land called the Netherlands?
Of course. Well, if you put Ruffalo, Dafoe, and Stone together, it makes a great movie. So I'm very eager to watch it. But I'm just not sure if I would watch it in the cinema because of its lively scenes. Did you watch it in the cinema?
Oh yes, absolutely. I don't think it's online yet, and I watched a preview though, so it hasn't reached cinemas. It's not here.
Right. So how did people respond when they saw those scenes? Were they just awkwardly looking away?
I mean, put it this way, critics, you always have a silence, so you would never, from a critical audience, you'd never get the idea. Whereas watching Maestro, you could feel there's an electricity there, there's a connection, especially when the real Leonard Bernstein appeared with the time of the subtitles. And it's fascinating that no one moved, and that really, I think, was a tribute to a film which, yes, I hope it scores all the awards too. So you wouldn't, if people were embarrassed, firstly, critics wouldn't want to show it, and you wouldn't see it in that context. But I'm afraid if people didn't want to see it, of course, and this, I'm glad I've stimulated some curiosity in everybody, because it's certainly something I was amazed by. But you would, only embarrassment would manifest itself in empty cinemas. That's the one thing we don't want to see.
Or maybe you should just actually say, have a merry cringe-mas if you wish to actually find things certainly cringe-worthy. Meanwhile, The World We Left Behind, Richard.
Oh, yes, a movie that's doing well. It's online, and I have to say, I can see why. I was very tired, I have to admit, when I happened to watch this, and getting up the next morning, the first thing I did was to watch the end of it, which has actually been controversial because a lot of people have expressed their doubts as to whether or not it works, it worked for me. Produced, written and directed by Sam Esmail, based on a novel by Romain Allam, and we meet Amanda Sanford, played by Julia Roberts. She decides to take her family for an unplanned vacation on Long Island, her husband, an academic, Clay, played by Ethan Hawke, and two kids, Rose, played by Para McKenzie, and Archie, played by Charlie Evans, are with her. She's not fond of people. Why is that? And what do we learn about these characters and experience that, putting it mildly, is not the one they were looking for? Because they reach an Airbnb, it's holiday property rentals, and it's near a beach, and all sorts of strange things are starting to happen, because they can't get the Wi-Fi, and Rose can't find the last episode of Friends, and actually they go to the beach, they see an oil tanker beach itself, which is pretty scary, deer are appearing near the house. All of this is very strange. It's not just what the story is. The story, incidentally, it starts to get spookier and spookier when they get a knock at the door. George H. Scott, known as G.H., played by Mahershala Ali, and his daughter Ruth, played by Myhala, show up, and they can't cope in town. There are all sorts of weird things going on. So they say the house is theirs, even if it's been rented out, and black out the city. So they're coming home. Now, this isn't welcome, especially Amanda's very, very, very suspicious. The thing is, Ruth's mother's flying back from Morocco, but something seems to have got wrong with that flight. You get a lot of resentment, and you also get the racial undertones of very, very clearly what's going on in Amanda's mind, especially since it's very late, they've got children, and they don't know who these people are, and it's perfectly clear that GH has another agenda. This is quite clever with the movie. You say it's playing with your sensibilities, and the way the scenes are shot, overhead shots, the way the house has a character of its own, the way you're getting the feeling that something very, very spooky and weird and strange is going on. Now, what is that? Because they all want to know. Or does perhaps G.H. already know? This is a plot that develops throughout. Amanda discovers news alerts, blackouts with hackers, and they're a long way away from everybody else. That makes it far more difficult to understand precisely what is going on. Clay tries to drive to town, but a whole load of cars that drive themselves have blocked the route. In the meantime, a Spanish woman, desperate for help, bangs on his door, and, well, he's suspicious because she seems alien, she seems foreign. There's an obvious message here against prejudice against immigrants and also racial prejudice, because that has one of the themes in this. But also, what you've got, G.H., he goes to try and find out what's going on, and he sees an airplane crash, there's something weird there, and he sees bodies strewn around the beach with the tanker, and Rose and Archie explore the garden and find a shed, and then Archie's bitten by a tick. What happens to him? When your teeth start falling out, it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And with the self-driving cars blocking the highways and with flamingos in the swimming pool, you can imagine that something very peculiar is happening there. And now you've got a good cast, obviously, with Mahershala Ali, Julia Roberts, Ethan Hawke all doing their things. You know, this isn't a movie you're looking in great depths and a delineation of character, but what you are looking for is a continuation of a suspense. It's all so weird. It's well shot. It seems well scripted, and it draws you in. The point is, does it or does it not? And I can only say here that it fascinated me to the point where I find it thought-provoking. But I do have to reveal that a lot of people have not been very satisfied with the way it ends. They're clever set pieces in this movie because a series of weird events are drawing you in. Something strange with the animals, something strange with Wi-Fi, all sorts of possibilities, leaflets strewn around in Arabic and so on. So who's done what to whom? And what if you're in a country area and you can't easily find out, and your teeth fall out or start falling out? That too doesn't help. I found it a movie that gripped. It is too long at 2 hours 20. It's divided into sections, which was really not necessary, but I found it riveting.
So it'll just be a 7 from yourself and Richard, I suspect.
It will be 8.
Oh, 8 for that as well. Both 2 hours 20 minutes. So keeping on the 8 scenario, fear, is this something which you think, well, at least it'll prove that we always need to have good oral hygiene before we go and see a movie of such ilk?
Of course, you always need good oral hygiene. but I actually agree with the critics that said that there are so many loose ends at the end. And so the movie is quite slow, and it's and there's a lot of build up, and a lot of you get to know more about every character, and that is very, very interesting to see. But it just leaves you hanging at the end because it just stops, and it annoyed me because I was like, oh, we are so into it now, and I'm like invested in the characters, and like I know who you are now, and why do you respond to that like that, and they have such deep conversations, and then it just ends. It's like, and now, well, what do we do now?
You wait for Richard Fitzwilliams to give a review, and that's it, the end of everything.
Yeah.
What would your score have been then for this one, Via?
I think it would be quite low, 6.5, actually, if I can give half points.
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anna, is this one for your good self, or is it a case of if I'm going to invest 2 hours, 20 minutes in any sort of situation, it's probably not going to be a movie?
Well, I actually read the novel, so I'm quite eager to see the movie to compare it. But as far as I know, the writer said that the producer of the movie basically was able to create the scenario that he always thought of when writing the book. So I do believe if the writer said that it's going to be quite similar to the book. So if it's quite similar to the book, then it's most definitely will be for me and I will enjoy it. But Fia said that there are quite a few loose ends. So I'm waiting to see that part and see if the storyline is continued in quite a good way. Because if not, that would be a disappointment because the book was really good.
And clearly, if it references Friends, then it obviously scores 5 points to start off with from yourself, basically, just because it's actually mentioned that American series. Very popular in Bucharest, apparently, Natasha. Not sure whether Friends ever made it to Nottingham, but still, there we are. Or whether indeed there are any Friends in Nottingham these days. Anyway, what's your thought on this particular opus?
Oh, Richard, you tease me. You tease me. You had me hanging from like the first little. You gave this little, like this little sigh when you started this. When you started to give your beautiful review, and I'm thinking, oh, hang on, I'll get ready. And then you started, and you drew me in, and then you tell me that the end is not satisfying. And now I don't know what to think. I'm very upset.
I'm saying I fairly said, and been said again by Anna, there are those who feel that the ending is unsatisfying, but I was fascinated because it was also unusual. So I'm just trying to tempt you.
You've definitely tempted me. I think Anna's actually tempted me with a new book to add to my reading list, actually, if I'm being honest as well. It was really interesting listening to you unpack the scenarios, because as you were speaking about the events that were sort of happening, it really heavily reminded me of Edwin Muir's poem, The Horses, his post-apocalyptic poem. If I may, there's a particular section, if I might read it to you for a second, where it goes, "On the second day, the radios failed. We turned the knobs, no answer. On the third day, a warship passed us, heading north. Dead bodies piled on the deck. On the sixth day, a plane plunged over us into the sea. Thereafter, nothing. The radio's dumb." And just as you were like describing all the events that was happening, I had that sort of snippets of that sort of playing in my head, and I had to go and Google it. So if anyone's interested, it's a beautiful poem, by the way. Anyone who's listening, then definitely look it up. But that's what it reminded me of, and it gave me chills. So I definitely think I will see this movie. I'm tempted to even maybe read the book first. It's just so, well, I'm wondering if that's going to give me more. Oh, Richard says no. Richard's shaking his head, so maybe I should not. Okay, well, I will read the movie and maybe I will watch the movie, and if I'm dissatisfied, I'll read the book. Maybe that's the good way around to do it.
Very apt, very appropriate, and such a wonderful way of actually having some poetry, which takes away from the homage to Peter Morgan and his work on The Crown, which was obviously eviscerated by the Telegraph recently. Anyway, life continues. To Natasha Wanton, to Anna Koskinov, to Fia van der Bogaert, and to Richard Fitzwilliams, huge thanks as ever. And inevitably, we say those words that keep watching the movies as we'll be heading next time round into probably reviews of the year and maybe just some Wonka, and who knows, maybe even Aquaman.
AI or AI, I don't know. Artificial intelligence, I know you'll know exactly what it's all about. But what does it actually mean for the future? Well, we're delighted to welcome back to the program futurologist, author, podcaster, and United Nations speaker, who's also one of the top 50 female futurologists in the world, Tracy Follows, to actually talk with us today. Tracy, would you like to share with us initially, in terms of AI, how long is it before radio presenters are replaced? And I know that there are already radio stations that are run completely with AI in the world today already.
I think you're right, Alex. I think you have till Friday.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was anticipating, really. It's just as well I can actually turn to my academic work. Oh, hang on a minute. That's also a case of as university
Oh,
tutors,
yeah.
that's also going as well, isn't it? Is that probably going on till Monday then?
Yeah, Saturday afternoon, I hear.
Saturday afternoon, great. Okay, so I mean, this particular survey that we're going to be discussing, a quarter of us feel negatively about AI. Two-thirds say it's important in their day-to-day job. And clearly, there is an agenda which suggests that we should embrace the technology. We could work with the technology. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's going to mean we, in the words of Elon Musk, have so much time to kind of occupy ourselves with that, we just don't know what to do with ourselves.
Isn't it interesting over history that people have always made predictions that we'll have more leisure time? And so far, that has never come true. We're working harder than ever. Even when we have some leisure time, we find other jobs to do in it. So I've never really believed in that particular prediction.
Is it like
This,
the myth of the paperless office that, of course, email was supposed
yes.
to do away with, basically?
Exactly. There's many myths. And one of the myths about technology is that it will automatically obliterate existing roles or jobs. I mean, we hear that a lot, and you can put a bit of that down to doomerism. You can put a bit of that down to just a habit. And also there's a little bit of fear. But it's never really been the case. We've always had technology come online. And we've always found a way to evolve jobs and evolve working roles and find other things for people to do. I mean, if you think about when the car came along, who'd have predicted that we'd have something called an MOT that people would need to take their car to and have it serviced and do an MOT every single year, and a whole peripheral industry sprouts from that. Now, what this Future of Work survey from Virgin Media O2 Business has found is that over half, so 52% of workers are uncertain as to what job they're doing over the next 20 years. And I think, lots of us will feel that. But the survey digs down in particular to deskless workers. And it actually finds that whilst, 30% of them feel that there's a bit of loss of control over their roles, through, as you say, through AI and automation, actually, a lot of them feel that they're positive about it. 36% are excited about the possibilities, but what they'd really love is better communication with head office. So these people that are not at their desk, not at the desktop in an office all the time, have opinions, have ideas about technology and how it could augment their roles and how it can integrate with what they do. But 53% of them want better communication from head office. They want to feel consulted. And I think that's a big part of this.
Now, as we construct this interview or develop this interview, Tracy, clearly we're using technology. We're using the technology of Zoom. As I speak to you, my colleague and office buddy is actually sort of busily working in the background as well. We're coordinating all manner of other aspects within that whole system. You've got some interesting predictions about where we're going to be in the next, say, 50 to 20 years, including the notion that most traditional salaries will no longer exist, and employees will be able to choose how they are paid, driven by their own politics and ethics. That's fairly radical, isn't it, Tracy?
I thought, yes, why not? Let's be radical. I'm not saying that all traditional salaries will no longer exist. What I am saying is that there will be complementary new payment methods, new types of digital currencies or alternative currencies, and that as power shifts away from institutions towards individuals, even in the workspaces, that the individual employees will, you know, have more of a say in how they are paid, when they are paid, and in what currency. So let's say 20 years from now, and I am mainly talking about people who don't necessarily work in offices. If you think that they are in, you know, customer service or retail or hospitality, why should they wait a month to be paid? I mean, some people will be paid at the end of the week, but a lot of people are still on monthly salaried payments. Now, when you were doing a job like that, you really should be paid dynamically in real time. And AI obviously can help analyze that, but so can lots of other converging technologies. So that if you have a high customer satisfaction or you have performed over and above targets, you know, if you're waiting a table or whatever it might be for that hour, then you should be paid a bonus for that task. You should be paid a micro payment for micro tasks. I think as we see the world of work go global, and that lots of these traditional roles can be split into individual roles or tasks, then we should expect to be compensated in novel ways, actually.
You are the author, of course, of The Future of You, Can Your Identity Survive 21st Century Technology? I mean, what you've been saying, I can see people reading a number of things into it. They could say, yeah, it's all very well about these financial payments, but doesn't that increase the risk of fraud if you're a tech sort of savvy soul? Or is it a case of we do need to take a deep breath and actually ensure that if we have faith in the future, it'll have faith in us?
Well, I think there are lots of pilots and experiments we can do. I think these alternative currencies are on the back of cryptography. Now, cryptography is supposedly more secure. So actually, we are looking at more secure ways of delivering payments that, you know, circumvent traditional models. But I guess that's also what Virgin Media O2 Business are trying to do. They're trying to say that there are solutions, there are support, there are help mechanisms that we can give you as individual employees, but also businesses, small or large, transition to this, I would say, this era of connectivity to a new era of advanced connectivity. I think that's what we're talking about, really. And that's what some of these new emerging technologies involve. They involve the understanding of advanced connectivity, not just between humans, but between humans and machines now.
And clothes, presumably, because wearables, which have often spoken about as being ideal to actually replace the notion of earpieces, Bluetooths and other sort of aspects, we are looking at connected clothing as well that could be impacting, I see.
Yeah, it could be connected clothing. I mean, you see it already in sort of caps, helmets, hats, cycle helmets, things like that. It could be into jackets, but it could be into personal effects as well. The interesting point here, if you think about it in the realm of work, is you do think about uniforms. You think about people who are outside of the office environment, you know, whether it's in healthcare or hospitality or maybe retail even. If they're wearing a uniform, why shouldn't that uniform be intelligent? Why shouldn't it be a sort of a way of connecting to some analysis, some monitoring, some data that actually can be useful to the wearer? So we already have what they call digital phenotyping, where you can pick up lots of information, lots of data from the environment, not just the user of a wearable or a piece of technology like a smartphone, but actually it can pick up lots of information from the environment. It could be noise, could be temperature, could be pollution, for example. So you could see that being a really interesting application going forward.
Tracy, it sounds quite frankly quite fascinating, and in terms of the whole system, I'm sure we'll be no pun intended following the whole process as it continues to unfold upon us. Would you actually just share with us how people actually get in touch with the Virgin Media O2 Business to actually see the findings and the results of the survey they came up with?
Of course, you can go to the Virgin Media O2 Business website, and there you'll get the highlights from the research, my predictions, and also some help and advice to support businesses of any size.
And as visiting professor of digital futures and identity at Staffordshire University, how can people obviously keep up to date with your own passage of life, Tracy?
Oh, indeed. You can visit me at www.tracyfollows.com.
Exactly. Although I think you should actually have a bracket. Tracy follows, but not just anybody. Close brackets. No, just a line. Tracy, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. Keep on keeping on, and hopefully we'll speak again in the very near future.
Thanks so much, Alex. Bye.
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
And it will be. I've seen the future and it works. If there's life after, we will see. So I can't go like a jerk. Systematic overthrow of the humble class. Hollywood conjures images of the past. New world needs spirituality that will last. I've seen the future and it will be. I've seen the future and it will be. I've seen the future and it works. With this life after, we will see. So I can't go like a jerk. Yellow smiley off of me ex. Like it's drinking 7 up. I would rather drink 6 razor blades. Razor blades from a paper cup. Can't understand, I say too tough. It's just that I've seen the future. Boy, it's rough. I've seen the future and it will be. I've seen the future and it works. If there's life after, we will see. So you can't go like a jerk. No, no.
Future.